because genocide against native people is still going on today all over the world.
Native Solidarity News. It's about you, too. CKUT, CKDU, CFBEX, CFUV, CHFN, CHLY, CHMA, CHSR, CJLY, CJSF, CJSW, Radio 90.
Based on land. Land is the basis of all independence.
Our first story comes to us through the Associated Press and the New York Museum of Arts and Design webpage. The second installment of a contemporary Native arts exhibit at the Museum of Arts and Design in New York City opened this week and will continue until this coming January. The exhibit was originally meant to have only one installment and was to be a survey of contemporary Native American artists from across the United States. However, the organizers said it took about 6 weeks for them to realize there was no way they could fit all the work they were finding into one exhibit. So the one show was broken into three separate shows, divided by geography. The first show, which opened in 2002, focused on the southwestern United States, including the four states of Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah. The current installment is called Changing Hands, Art Without Reservation 2, Contemporary Native North American Art from the West, Northwest, and Pacific. This edition will focus on the Plains, Prairie, and Plateau regions from west of the Mississippi River to the continental west coast, including California, Oregon, and Washington, and further westward to Hawaii and northward to include Canada's Pacific Northwest coast and Alaska. A third show focusing on art from the area to the east of the Mississippi is planned for 2008 or 2009. The current exhibit covers three floors in the museum's Midtown Manhattan location and features more than 300 works in a variety of media from over 180 established and emerging artists. This wide coverage makes Changing Hands 2 one of the most comprehensive exhibits to explore currents in contemporary Native arts. Materials range from the more traditional, clay, glass, fiber, metal, wood, and jewelry, to the innovative and contemporary, including video, plastics, and found objects. There are examples of intricate beadwork on purses and belts, and even sneakers. One piece is a game of cowboys and Indians on a chessboard, on which the castles on the cowboy's side are a fort and an outhouse, and on the Indian side are teepees. There are masks done in the style of the Haida people of the Pacific Northwest, but with non-traditional shapes and images, and much more. The curators, David McFadden and Ellen Tobin, hope that the exhibition will establish a new dialogue that embraces not only the past, but more importantly, the present and future of Native art. The show is divided into four sections. One deals with the influence and inspiration of nature, another with social identity and the human condition, a third with how materials are used, and the fourth with an object's form and function. One thing the show doesn't deal with is artists' tribal affiliations, McFadden said, because that's not what the curators want viewers to concentrate on. Quote, we want them to look at what the art says about culture in general, about issues in general, and not to get all hung up on whether or not someone is Zuni or Hopi or whatever, he said. It's not important. McFadden says he hopes the show's audience comes away with a sense of the vitality of Native American art. Quote, Indian art is not dead, he said. It's continuing to change, and our ideas about Indian art have to be reformulated. The show will travel extensively after its New York run. It will be exhibited in Santa Fe, Indianapolis, Naples, Florida, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Anchorage, Alaska, and Minneapolis. Other sites may be added. In other arts-related news, this past weekend in Vancouver, there was a showcase of Michael Nicol Yagulana's work. Yagulana is a classically trained Haida artist and has fused his work with Japanese manga forms to create strips and images that illustrate Haida stories. Japanese manga is a form of graphic storytelling that uses bold shapes and colors and is a dynamic and popular form of communication in Japan, Korea, and China. Although Yagulana's earliest works date to the mid-70s, Haida manga emerged in 2001 with the publication of Yagulana's first book, A Tale of Two Shaman. The small book combined Yagulana's art with essays by David Suzuki, Suzuki's daughter Severn, and the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai. The whole idea of the story, said Yagulana, is to have people get to acknowledge their own power, their own capacity to make decisions that have impact. Yagulana has found considerable success with his art in Japan and has most recently been invited to paint his Haida manga live at Expo 2005 in Aichi, Japan. Canadian audiences have been slower to catch on to his work, although his second publication, The Last Voyage of the Black Ship, has been dubbed an artifact by British Columbia's Museum of Anthropology and is now held behind a glass case. Yagulana is currently working on a manga about the War of the Blink, a Haida story about a battle that gets preempted when one warrior flinches at a fly, thus ending the war. For more information and pictures of his work, go to www.rockingraven.com. That's www.rockingraven.com.
He goes to bed and his mom coaches his evening prayer. And he knows the Creator loves him. Brought up to believe every man's just the same in a world blessed with a child loving eyes. He studies the glances and listens to the whispers of the differences in another's face. With his eyes cast down, his heart reaches for them in a world that can't love them the same. He's a believer looking for the truth in America. In America, trusting in the grace of his God goes he, in America. His tears answer the rage of the riots in L.A. And he wonders why there ain't enough love to go around in America. With his hand on his heart at the baseball game, he sings his national anthem. He remembers the things that were taught him in school, and he remembers all his heroes. He walked with you streets of Selma, Alabama, and as a child you questioned the war.
He stood with his brother in his stand that wounded me and died countless times for the things that he believed. He's a believer looking for the truth in America. In America, trusting in the grace of his God goes he. In America, his tears answer the rage of the riots in LA, and he wonders why there ain't enough love to go around in America. In America.
That was Vince Tui. JJ is back with us. She's going to give us some more news from our Red Nation.
Okay, our next story is on the Canadian Aboriginal Music Awards. They have announced their nominees on Wednesday, September 21st. It's the 7th annual Canadian Aboriginal Music Awards, and among the nominees are some of the most talented Aboriginal artists and music industry professionals in all aspects of Aboriginal music. Each year, the Canadian Aboriginal Music Awards celebrates the musical contributions of Aboriginal people by honoring the premier musicians, groups, and industry members across Canada. To qualify for a Canadian Aboriginal Music Award, nominees must be Canadian Aboriginal, status, non-status, Métis, or Inuit, by birth, adoption, or community acceptance. Topping the nominations with 5 nominations each are Nunavut artist Tagak for her album Sina, with nominations for Best Female Artist, Best Female Traditional / Cultural Roots Album, Best Producer / Engineer, Best Album Cover Design, and Best Inuit Cultural Album. And Manitoba's Burnt Project 1 for their album Hometown, which has 5 nominations for Best Rock Album, Best Producer / Engineer, Best Group or Duo, Best Album Cover Design, and Best Album of the Year. Asani's Rattle and Drum, Little Hawk's 1492 to 1975, and Forever's Something to Dream Of, both received all three of those received three nominations each. In other news, funding has been delayed for Sisters in Spirit campaign as Native women continue to vanish. This article is taken from an article by Sue Bailey, writing for Canadian Press. Funding has still not arrived, despite the disappearance of 6 more Aboriginal women since Ottawa announced $5 million last May to help stem a growing epidemic. A federal official says the cash is held up by unavoidable red tape to ensure money is well spent. But the head of the Native Women's Association of Canada says urgent work is being delayed amid a shocking number of unsolved deaths and appearances. Her group says preliminary research and anecdotal evidence suggests at least 500 Native women have vanished or been killed in the last 20 years. Reliable statistics do not exist, however. The $5 million promised over 5 years, which is far short of the $10 million requested over 2 years, is to fund more research, a database, and a hotline. Nancy Waugh, spokesman for Status of Women Canada, says the new funding has to be cleared by the Treasury Board, and these assessments are held only in June and October. Cabinet approved funding in May, but Waugh said there wasn't enough time to prepare for the last Treasury Board reviews in June. That meant having to wait until the next round, which is coming up in mid-October. The cash will likely flow by November, barring any unexpected hurdles. However, fallout from the sponsorship scandal has slowed funding requests. Quote, government is being scrutinized every step of the way, quote, Waugh said. The Auditor General and others are watching. It's a cumbersome process, but we have to follow what the rules are. Last October, Amnesty International Canada called on governments and Native groups to publicly condemn the high rates of violence against Indigenous women and take action. There is little agreement on the exact number of missing Native women. However, there is agreement that the numbers are likely high and that there is a serious cross-Canada problem that has been minimized or ignored in the past by the police and the media. Among those reported missing since last May are Amber Redmond, 19, of the Standing Buffalo First Nation northeast of Regina, and Melanie Dawn Geddes, who was last seen in Regina at about 1 a.m. on August 13th. Anyone with information is asked to call the Fort Capelle RCMP at 1-306-332-2222. Next, we have a press release from a group called the Indigenous Peoples of Taiwan. We're going to jump right across the ocean there. On Thursday, September 22nd, 60 Aboriginal Taiwanese people, led by legislator Cao Chin-Sumei, one of the first Aboriginal Taiwanese women elected to the Taiwanese Parliament, made an historical visit to the United Nations. The delegation is a culmination of 3 years of quote-unquote incessant protest from the Aboriginal Taiwanese community. They are searching for recognition of the brutality perpetrated against them by Japan during its 50-year colonization of Taiwan from 1895 to 1945. The group also visited the Flying Eagle Women Fund, an American Indian community house, on Thursday. This visit, quote, would fulfill the Aboriginal Taiwanese people's wish to meet with the American Indian community, their indigenous brothers and sisters on Turtle Island. Out of Taiwan's total population of 21.3 million, there are more than 350,000 who are indigenous tribal peoples. Distinguished from the majority Han Taiwanese, indigenous tribal groups are part of the so-called Malayo-Polynesians. Linguistically, they are recognized as subgroups of the Austronesian-speaking family. Therefore, they are also called Austronesians. Despite the fact that their languages are derived from the same root, the languages they currently speak are not mutually comprehensible between groups. The main indigenous groups in Taiwan are Ami, Atayal, Paiwan, Bunun, Rukai, Puyuma, Tsu, Saisia, Yami, and Pinpu, all of which are recognized as indigenous peoples by the Taiwanese government. These groups, along with many other Taiwanese people, suffered during Japan's occupation of Taiwan from the late 1800s to the end of World War II. Japanese colonization, to give you a brief background, of the island fell under three stages. It began with an impressive period of crackdown and paternalistic rule, followed by a Doka period of segregation, and finally, during World War II, a period of Kominka, a policy whose intent was to eliminate potential sympathies for the Chinese nationalist causes on the mainland and to instill the Japanese spirit in Taiwanese residents, that's quote-unquote Japanese spirit, turning them into loyal subjects of the Japanese Empire. Compulsory measures included Japanese language education, the adoption of Japanese names, and the worship of Japanese religion were all instituted. Japan lost control of Taiwan as part of its surrender at the end of World War II, but it has never fully acknowledged the atrocities visited upon Taiwanese Aboriginal peoples during the rule of the island. That recognition is what the delegation to the UN is seeking. For more information, you can visit their website at www.indigenouspeople.net/taiwan.htm. That is www.indigenouspeople.net/taiwan.htm.